Well, good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Mary Mullen, a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be both an open-minded and an open-hearted congregation, and we do welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, your sexual orientation, your gender, or your family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age, no matter what your abilities or your inabilities. And later in the service, we'll invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They're presented either by a Prairie member, or a member of the wider community. We're presently recruiting for a minister since our minister went off to Sweden. Today we'll be hearing from a longtime member, Peter Anderson. And he'll be presenting Childhood's End. Doesn't sound like a very happy sort of thing. We'll find out. The Hughes family, Heidi, Rachel, and James will be lighting our chalice.
A prayer of sorrow. We have forgotten who we are. We have alienated ourselves from the unfolding of the cosmos. We have become estranged from the movements of the earth. We have turned our backs on the cycles of life. We have sought only our own security. We have exploited simply for our own ends. We have distorted our knowledge. We have abused our power. Now the land is barren, the waters are poisoned, and the air is polluted. Now the forests are dying, and the creatures are disappearing, and the humans are despairing. We ask forgiveness. We ask for the gift of remembering. We ask for the strength to change.
Well, I'd like to introduce Peter Anderson, who will be giving the presentation on Childhood's End. I've known Peter for quite a while, and something I've always admired about him is that he really thinks out of the box. And you may know that he's the person that started Dane County Dances to try to get people of different ethnic groups together here in Madison, having a good time. You may know that he's from New York, from the Bronx, probably from his accent. And he told me today, I wondered how he came here because I never knew that. He came in 1970 for a political campaign. And he also started Environmental Decade, probably in 1970 also. He's a longtime environmental activist, now working mostly on climate change. His email says Recycle World, so we know that he's for recycling as well. So I'd like to invite Peter up to tell us about Childhood's End.
And backtracking for a moment, Alec Lohr's the opening words. The opening words, or Alex Lawrence, is a 12-year-old when he gave that speech, and he's dedicated his whole life. He's now 17, and you can watch him if you go onto YouTube. It's quite an experience.
What's his name again?
Alec Lohr, L-O-R-R-Z. And if I could get that stupid PowerPoint going, that'd be great. Thank you for having me. I appreciate being back. The whole commerce between master and slave is a perpetual exercise of the most boisterous passions, the most unremitting despotism on the one part and degrading submissions on the other. Our children see this and learn to imitate it, for man is an imitative animal. The parent storms, the child looks on, catches the lineaments of wrath, puts on the same airs in the circle of smaller slaves, gives a loose to his worst of passions, and thus nursed, educated, and daily exercised in tyranny, cannot be stamped by it with its odious peculiarities. The man must be a prodigy who can retain his manners and morals, undepraved by such circumstance. And I think many of us having looked at the internal contradictions of Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, said, how could such an individual, so noble in intent, and the reason is, of course, is that when it came to Mount Vernon and all the creature comforts that he enjoyed in that in his home, he couldn't bear to give them up. And he would rather live with those internal contradictions than forego those joys. And the reason I'm mentioning that is I think that we have the same thing here. Especially after the BP disaster, I used to have a Corolla like this, and to be environmental and be very much in the sway of the green revolution, I got a hybrid Prius. But the problem with the benefit from getting a hybrid Prius is that I used to drive with my non-hybrid. I used to drive about 7,000 miles a year. And with my Prius, I'm now driving about 14,000 miles a year. So any benefit that I could claim about being green and noble has been washed out. I don't know where the heck I'm driving. Excuse me. Remember after we saw Inconvenient Truth, we had the things, what to do? Well, get fluorescent, complex fluorescent bulbs. And we thought, well, that's a nice start, I suppose. And then some people said, well, this is a couple you may have saw in the Wisconsin State Journal highlighted. It was a home on Ross Street, not too far from where I live. And they were very proud, this couple, because they were the first platinum lead house in Madison, in the whole state of Wisconsin. And you can see there are solar collectors, insulated, rain gardens, the whole nine yards. And I want to compare with that house on Division Street. I want to ask you a question. Which one has a smaller carbon footprint? Which one has this one? And that prior one, 2,700 square feet, two people live in that. Two people. And I'm trying to look down on people. Molly and I live in a house that's 2,500 square feet. We used to have six people, and now we're down to three. We got to get rid of that monster. But the things that go on is you have to understand this. If you look at the stuff that we have to do to go and get these kind of things going on, before I get to that, the whole issue has been put about what we need to do to avoid the climate catastrophe that we all have read about. And I think there's no time to go into that as well, except to note that all the things that you've heard about, if we have a business as usual and the temperatures will rise by the end of the century from 5 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit, all those kinds of projections ignored the worst case possibility, and they ignored the positive feedback loops that we might be getting into. One of the worst ones you can think of is the tundra is getting warmer, and that's going to release massive amounts of methane, which has 25 to 100 times more warming potential than carbon dioxide. So everything you've heard about how bad climate change is and the risk it poses to the civilization that we have known, everything that comes out in each additional day, as more and more unknowns are resolved, it's worse, and it's going more and more to the worst end of the predictions and not to anything in the best. So the consequences that we are leaving for our children, the Sophie's choice that we're making for our progeny, is just terrible. And the whole thing that's been going on in the terms of what is the process to improve this has been looking at things like going beyond the compact fluorescent bulbs to carbon trading. And the bill that was considered for about a year and a half in the House before it got buried in the Senate would have provided a carbon trading bill. And the problem with that, even if it had passed, is the kind of, and that was, and the reason why we were using a bill like that to try and address climate change when there was still a hope, this is before the November election, of something passing, was because it was thought it would be too hard to go and directly address it, so we had provided an ability for companies to trade their carbon demands on them by buying the rights to someone else who would reduce it. And we've seen the kinds of things that this had, and it built upon the success when they had SO2 tr- carbon trading back in 1990, which worked well because that was electric utility companies, and it was measured emissions that were exact and not modeled. And because everything was actually recorded in regulatory agencies, everything was on paper, there was no room for cheating. But when you get to carbon trading, it's all loosey-goosey. So 66% of the carbon trading that was going on under the clean mechanism in the last year was based upon a total scam. When we had the HFCs, the refrigerants that were poisoning, they were destroying the ozone layer, they went to a version, another isotope 23. Well, that has the unfortunate attribute of not destroy the ozone layer, it has 11,000 times the warming potential of carbon dioxide. Well, there are factories in India, there are about 24 of them, that continue to pump out HFC 23 refrigerants for the sole purpose of then agreeing not to pump them out and making these trades. And because it's 11,000 times the multiplier, on a weighted basis, it dominates the whole process. So it's just so lends itself to scams. And then if it's not being scammed, so much of the political process in terms of carbon trading, which is the best we possibly could get, and we didn't get in Congress, is basically subject to hijacking. You've heard, I'm sure, about the revelations about corn-based ethanol, which instead of saving climate, actually makes it twice as bad. And you heard about hydraulic fracking of natural gas. That makes it twice as worse because of the leakage. Another one I work on a lot is landfill gas energy. That makes it about four times worse. All these things that have been putting up there in lights to make things better are really things that have been bribed through the congressional process, the administrative process, which actually, when people independently look at them, makes things worse. This is a list. One of the major activists in climate change is a guy named Joe Rome. He has a blog called Climate Progress. He set out to say, well, what do we got to do to actually address the issue of climate change? And this was a list of things he came out with, and you can look upon, and that we have to do in the next couple of years, worldwide. All cars, 60 miles per gallon, 4,000 gigawatts of wind turbines, 5,000, enormous task. And you know what Joe forgot to think about, though, is this is only if we look upon the emissions today as baseline, and we don't consider another factor. Let me see if this bugger will work. Right. This, remember about 10 years ago, there was a wonderful book came out, Material Worlds, and they asked people from around the world to take everything in their house, possessions, and put them in front of the house and have a picture taken. This one's India, and that's America. It was a very, very sobering experience. And essentially, the first world's consumption per capita is 32 times the third world's. And what Joe didn't put into the equation is China and India and the rest of the third world might not want to have a carbon reduction regimen that consigns them to poverty for the rest of their life while we drive around in highly efficient BMWs. That's not going to fly. Essentially, if you wanted to bring all of the third world up to our consumption level, you would need 12 worlds of materials and energy. And so people talk about, well, we get more efficient and more this and more that and more solar. There's no way that we can, well, it might work on a U.S. basis if that was our only horizon line of the continental United States. But if we're looking about the situation with climate change, there's no way we're going to get efficiency gains or renewable introductions which are going to provide 12 globes of world. Essentially, what's going on here is we want the United States and Europe want to have a regimen for a global treaty to replace Kyoto that would say, let's have reductions based upon our total emissions. And if your total emissions today are such and such, you reduce them by 10 or 20%. Well, China looks at that graph and says, hell with that. That means I'm going to be having all our people as peasants for the rest of their lives. They say, on a per capita basis, you're 19 times what we are. And we're going to be damned if we're going to sign any treaty that locks us into our people being impoverished. So essentially, what's not being talked about in any of these discussions is looking past the borders of continental United States out to the rest of the world, and what our desire, just like Thomas Jefferson's, to continue enjoying our ultra conference. Like we have 2,500 square feet, two cars, and whether we have to actually think far deeper than that and go beyond the kinds of discussion we've had having. I think the problem, it seems to me, is that the synapses in terms of human nature do not look at tomorrow. So I remember last year when we had the discussion about the BP disaster, and people were fulminating about BP's transgressions, and I got up and said, well, that's very nice, but who amongst us has given up their second car? And I got people very upset. Well, there, Barb did. And Al did, Al did. But on the way home, Molly and I talked about it. How are we going to get rid of that second car? And then we said, well, who's going to carry Jed here? Who's going to do this? Who's going to... We've been mumbling back and forth for the last year, and we still have a goddamn second car. and the problem, I think, is, I'm someone who understands the implications of our selfishness. I mean, I think ultimately, the situation is our synapses are not geared to act upon what problems are tomorrow. They only act if the water and the floods are only up to our nose. It may not be enough. It actually may have to be up to our eyeballs before we are ready. We're ready to act in terms of making systemic change, which means something beyond getting a Prius, which is your second car. And I think essentially, people are unable to do that. Is my feeling. And what's the solution? I'd never like to just groan and get crawled into a cave and go, woe is me. I think it's our youth. And being someone from the 60s, I remember the revolution that occurred, that could have occurred. And it's not that the people who are young don't have the same problems with the synapse limitations that we do, but you just haven't entered the world. You don't worry about your job yet. You're also more reckless and you are willing to leap off the cliff. And I think also that the young can be brought into play by using mechanisms like getting people mad, substituting anger for our inability to look beyond tomorrow, to tell the kids, your parents, which is us, our grown-ups, have totally screwed up the world. And unless you get on the stick like Alex Lawrence is doing and basically go into the streets en masse and overcome the entire structural system, I mean, I was in lobbying in Washington last month when a bill to repeal the Clean Air Act's provision that allows them to nominally go after climate change. And I stopped in at Tammy Baldwin's office. Tammy Baldwin. And they reamed me out because when the bill was passed in the House for climate change a year ago, the staffer in the Government Accountability Office didn't put a impact analysis out on that bill, economic impact analysis out, until after the bill was passed. And they were appalled, Tammy Staffer said, to read that the bill would have big impacts on the industries which are energy intensive in the United States, in Wisconsin. She said, you can't do that. But next time the bill comes up, we got to have a hold harmless for them. I said, if we're going to hold everyone who's going to be impacted by higher carbon prices harmless, how are you going to have any change? And that's Tammy Baldwin. And you know, Tammy Baldwin is the radical fringe of Congress. Imagine the rest of the Congress. So we have to find ways. And I think, for me, I think, how am I going to find structures to send the message to the youth of today that the grown-ups have screwed up and it's time for you to take over? And I think back to, I think it was 1959, I read Arthur Clarke's Childhood's End, which has a story about the far advanced civilization, and the only people they can salvage out of the earth is the kids, and everyone else is basically holding everything back. And I think that's the situation we're in today. And so my hope is not in the political process of which I've been intimately involved with, which I think is not going to do a damn thing. Our only hope that I can see is if we can get the kids angry enough at the grown-up generation, at us, to say, you screwed us up, and I'm not going to let you screw up the world that we're going to live in, because we may be dead when all the impacts come due. And we may take quiet solace in that secretly in the crevices of our mind. Well, at least I won't be around to see it. But they will. And it's all on their backs, essentially, because I don't think we're capable of doing anything when it comes to systemic change, even though we have so much economic benefits and creature comforts, there's no reason why we couldn't have a very wonderful lives with half of that. It's not like it's anything that's impossible to do. is changing the habits of the heart, and there's nothing harder than that. But my hope is in childhood's end. Thank you very much. And I love to have, I know we only had like one time for one question last time. I want to have a lot of questions this time. The problem I have is that civilization, in my experience, is a very thin veneer. And it works, look at Nazi Germany. And I think that when you start shaking the edges of it and all the things that people rely upon, it doesn't just ratchet down slowly. Civilization is very beneficent, but it's very fragile and subject to catastrophic collapse. And I think we have to be more aggressive. I don't think saying do what we can and then do the best, bear the best. I think that's not an option because civilization. Look at what happens when the bubonic plague hit Europe. It's just the kind of things that we're going to see if we let this occur. Are so catastrophic in terms of civilization's collapse, it wouldn't be feasible. I think that.
Do you think we can stop it?
I don't think you and I can stop it. I think that's why I said it has to be the kids. I think the wealth is there to have a. You know, what you want to do is have the ability to not be afraid of not having food. You want to have a shelter over your head. You want to have a friend. You want to have a wife. You want to have kids. All the things that we have that consume so much, like that lead platinum house. It's not necessary to enjoy a safe, comfortable life. And I think it's that ratcheting down process where I would aim it, not saying I'm going to try and make the best of it after it comes. That's where I'm at. The pre-industrialization level of carbon in the it was 280 parts per million. Now it is 385. It's expected to go to 450 pretty soon. And the scientists who are most concerned with this think we have to go back to 350 to stabilize things. And so when they say go back to 350, they say people are not willing to give up their second car and their SUV. They say, what the hell do we have to throw at this bugger to make all those things work out? And that's what they threw at it. It's basically the rebound problem, because when you have wealth, if you save it by doing something more efficiently here, what do you do with the rest of it? Do you give it to the poor or do you buy something else? And that's one of the big problems is. But on the thrust though, even Illich I think is right on. I don't think communism can impose. Suppose that was a list that would work, and capitalism. I don't think communism is a solution to impose it, because any government, especially illegitimate government, has to win the tacit, quiet support of its people by giving them goodies. And the Soviet Union, when it collapsed, had its most terrible pollution. So essentially, it requires a mind change, not a system of one form of industrial organization to another form of industrial organization. And I think, although it sounds pie in the sky, generational changes can be enormous. I don't think we have to, the scale of that, the capability of generational change is better. Within a generation, once you've developed the habits of the heart, which is exactly why advertisers don't advertise to people over 40, because they have too many habits, they're not going to change. It's essentially possible to stop, and plus our inability to look at tomorrow. Yeah. I've been lobbying for 40 years in the political process, and I can't, I always look for leverage, and I never say you can't do it, but I always figure out all the angles, but I can't figure out the angle to do that after I watch what's going on. The process was one which would come out at the end of the pipe worse than when it started, it's so bad. And of course, with a Supreme Court unraveling everything with campaign finance. So I'd like to think it's true, I don't. Well, I don't follow very closely the Europe numbers, except going and visiting the same thing, but in general, a suburban lifestyle uses twice as much energy as an urban lifestyle. So it's a big ticket item. And of course, looking at Madison 40 years ago to what it is brought out today, you can just cry. In the 60s, my experience was that about two-thirds of the shock troops weren't really radical people. It was the cool thing to do. And I'm looking for ways to exploit the way young people think to make, again, it's very easy to get kids to be angry at grown-ups. And so I'm looking at mechanisms that I'm not, we were kids once too, we're not criticizing a different beast, a different species. And the kind of thing I've been thinking about is having some kind of integrated rock concert where it has yak with the talk, with the music in the background, all aimed at about how your parents are screwing up your world for you. And then having them targeted to go out the door, not snapping their fingers, but doing a direct action in someone's face who's like electric. So I don't pretend to have an answer, but I just think it's important to at least start in a new direction. Last 2 years, the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Environmental Defense Council, all those great groups that we give money to, they spend $350 million on climate change in Congress to get a terrible bill passed in the House that couldn't get a vote in the Senate. And my point, and the take I'd like to leave with you is, that is a dead end. And what their proposal is for this year is to double down the same bad bet after the November election. I mean, where are we? It's not going to come from our environmental leadership. It has to come from below, a rethinking of where we're headed. And I'm not here saying, here's the exact answer. I'm saying, here's the direction I think has the only sense of hope to avoid Rick's terrible depression.